I think there is nothing stronger than creativity. We are ambassadors to the human soul. So embrace your creatives, embrace creativity in yourself.
You're listening to the No Labels, No Limits podcast with best-selling author Sarah Box. We focus on the mantra, no labels, no limits, no excuses. And now without further ado, please welcome your commanding coach with plenty of chutzpah and heart, Sarah Box.
Hey there, No Labels, No Limits podcast listeners. Welcome back. I'm Sarah Box, your host of the No Labels, No Limits podcast, where we're on a mission to help individuals, teams, and organizations, and particularly my nonprofit friends, to think outside the box, move beyond limiting beliefs, and create profound impact in the lives of others and themselves on the way. Now, we do this by sharing accomplished guests, those who have challenged their own limiting beliefs and labels. Maybe they're pushing back against the norm in what people accept as the right and perfect way to do things. But as a result of doing that, they have accomplished their own personal and professional goals and can offer us insight. And today we have an incredibly talented guest joining us, Paul Pape. Now, let me tell you a little bit about Paul. He is a seasoned artist, and I'm going to tell you, I'm thinking seasoned with what? So he is an experienced artist. He's very seasoned. He's a designer and an entrepreneur, and he has over 20 years of experience in the whole creative industry field, which is a broad field. And his journey from an abusive childhood to becoming a successful creative entrepreneur is both inspiring and empowering. And he has a passion for educating and also for continuous learning. And that in turn has fueled his success and created thousands of personalized products for clients along the way. However, his journey doesn't even stop there. In recent years, Paul pivoted to empowering fellow creatives, sharing his expertise and insights to help them turn their passions into a thriving business. And as a speaker, educator, and mentor, he continues to inspire others to unleash their creative potential and find fulfillment in their personal and professional lives. He is a staunch advocate for breaking the starving artist trope. I have a question for him about that. And believing that creativity should not come at the cost of suffering, but rather be a cornerstone of our society's advancement. So with that as an introduction, let's formally welcome Paul to the podcast. Hi, Paul.
That was such a nice introduction. Hi, Sarah. Thank you very much. That was awesome.
Well, there's so much more to say about you. I figured, oh, let's save it for the interview. But I would like to start with you sharing, like, how did you get to where you are today? Like, what was that journey from being an artist and designer to then going into entrepreneurship and actually empowering other fellow creatives to transform in much the way that you did?
This, believe it or not, this story has a recent turn to it. I would say about 6 months ago, I met a coach that I had, and his big thing is he wants you to really explore your background and where you come from. And I told him, I said, I can't really remember my childhood. And he's like, well, I really want you to sit down and just kind of think about it. And I did. And, it unlocked some things in me that I was really surprised about. So where I got my start was I would always tell people I love to learn, and I do. I love to learn. My mother loves to tell this story. When I was in, after first grade ended, I came home off the bus and I cried for 3 days straight until she enrolled me in summer school. And I did summer school for 10 years. I did full year round school for 10 years. And I thought that's such an endearing thing because I just love to learn. But what it was is because my home life was not the best. It was, mentally and physically abusive is what it was. And that's what I uncovered. And so what I did was I was using school as like a sanctuary. So it was like my church. And so that's actually how I got started. So I just have a love of learning. And then in high school, I discovered theater. And I started off as an actor and I was not any good. I mean, I had good stage presence. I had a good voice, but I couldn't memorize anything. And so when I got to college, I took my first acting gig and, our acting class. And then the teacher there, the professor said, you'll never be on stage. We're just not going to let you. And I was kind of downbeaten, but I'm like, I'm going to do theater because I just love this theater thing. And so I met the dean of the college, and he said, would you like to learn everything? Because he said he saw that I was just absorb whatever I could get my hands on. And I said, absolutely. You know, I think I thought about it for maybe a millisecond before I was like, yeah, absolutely. Let's do this. And he taught me every aspect of theater, from management to design to acting to, you know, everything that you could get your hands on. And then from there, I just really like kind of delved into theatrical design. And I ended up going to California on a design scholarship. I won a few really high-end design awards. And then when I got my master's degree from University of California, San Diego, in the last week that I was there, I was working with a designer named John Arnone. And at the time, he had like 4 or 6 shows on Broadway. So he was like the pinnacle of scenic design, which is what I was studying. And I was talking to him. I said, well, how is it? And he goes, it's horrible. He goes, I travel 42 weeks out of the year. He goes, I can't set down roots. This is, and I'm like, why did you wait until after I graduated to tell me all this information? I'm like, what am I going to do with this? And so I was a little downtrodden on that one. I'm like, I don't know what I'm going to do with myself. And so my wife decided she didn't want to live in California anymore. So we moved back to Nebraska, where we're at now. And it just so happened that my undergrad had fired the scenic designer professor. And they're like, we need somebody to just step in. Will you step in? And so I did. And I was teaching it, but it was, I don't like to have a conformed job. I like to be super creative. And so it was difficult for me to kind of like fit the mold of professor, not from the teaching aspect, but from the bureaucracy aspect. And so I only lasted 3 years, but in my last year there, I had a student ask me to make him a figurine for his girlfriend for Valentine's Day. And this is in the early 2000s, before there was big internet everything. And he put it online, and it got picked up because it was based on a video game, and it got picked up by this blog. And it took off, and people started asking, can you make me this? Can you make me that? And I'm like, yeah, sure. And so I started making more on the side doing that than I was teaching. And so I asked my wife if I could quit, and the rest is kind of history. I just take everything that I can, and it's led to working for Disney and working for Nickelodeon. I've made literally thousands of pieces individualized for people all around the world.
Well, so that's a whirlwind trip down memory lane, if you will. But you know, it's so interesting that you're able to identify that you didn't fit the mold of like the bureaucracy that would be required to work in academia, right? Like the teaching part, the conveying information, all of the creative stuff. Thumbs up on that. So that's a great self-awareness. But I'm really curious why they wouldn't give you a stage presence. That just seems so arbitrary for someone to tell you you're never going to be on a stage. Because there you are, as a stage manager, in effect, you're on a stage. You may not be acting, but
I think what it was, I'll be the first to admit that I'm a headstrong individual, and I say mow my own path. And the professor, who was in charge of acting, I was an 18-year-old and had taken all the prerequisites for senior level courses. And so I interjected myself into one of her senior level courses, and she was not thrilled with that idea. And I think it was just like, I hate to say petty revenge, but I think that's what it was, is just that it's the power that she had. And at the time, I think I was a little bitter about it, but honestly, I think it worked out in my favor. So, you know,
in retrospect, things often do, but in the moment you're thinking, what's up with that? You
know? Absolutely. But I'm a big believer in divine doorways. Like if something that I am, my wife says, I believe in unicorns and rainbows. I am such an optimistic guy. I think the best of most people. And so I've never really been that guy who gets like so downtrodden on stuff that I just like, oh, woe is me. It's always like, okay, what's next?
Yeah. Make opportunity for yourself.
Yep.
So that's a fairly recent that you learned the impact of your childhood and how it affected your love of learning, right?
Absolutely.
What did you do with that information? Had you been aware of it, or did that just kind of like, then you had to mull that over and consider that as it had a trickle effect in your life?
Well, like I said, I'm a unicorns and rainbows kind of guy. So when I would reflect on my childhood, I saw everything as a positive. And uncovering, like, I'd never done therapy because not because I didn't think there was use for it, but I just thought there's nothing wrong. And it was funny because the coach that I'm using, he hates it when I call his coaching sessions classes, like classrooms. But to me, that's what it is, because that's where my sanctuary is. So when I'm in class, it took literally a guy in a classroom to say, you've got things you need to deal with. And when I started looking back on it, I'll admit, 48 years old, bald for like 4 days, just absolutely had a breakdown. And I'm like, and it dawned on me, I'm like, wow. It was so surprising to me that all of these things happened, and it really shaped who I was, and that I was using in like education as an escape. And it was such an epiphany for me, because I've always leaned toward, like, I'd get to school an hour and a half early, and I'm like, why would I get to school an hour and a half early? There's nobody. I was friends with the janitor because it's just me and him. And I'm like, why would I do that? And I just thought it was because I love school. And then in retrospect, I'm like, I see, it's literally an escape. And so, it was a lot of having to deal with some. I was flying back from this. I'm weeping on a plane. The guy next to me is like, "Are you all right?" And I'm like, "I'm fine. Just dealing with some stuff." But it hasn't really dealing with it. And I think that's a big part of it, is you can deal with, because you have to confront it, you have to hold it, you have to give it space, but then you can't let it have too much space. So I like to use this example where I'll put that on one side of a piece of paper and I put myself on the other. And then I fold it so that my name, it says you, but you is on the outside. So basically I'm enveloping it, because I don't want it to envelop me. And so I can put it in my pocket. I'm still carrying it. It's still there, but I believe that I'm bigger than it is. And it's just a part of me.
That's a great metaphor for it too, to picture it in that way. Because we all have stuff. Right, whether we choose to acknowledge it or not, that has shaped us, you know. And I think it's that I like the onion thing. It's like, so you know one layer, and then you like, oh, I wonder what else, you know. And of all the sanctuaries you could have picked, schooling, especially at a school where you felt safe and you could learn as much as you want, what a great choice versus some of the other not so positive ones.
Absolutely.
So I'm curious, let's talk about this whole starving artist trope.
Please.
So talk about that. Let's start with that and define what that is. And when you're doing that, if you could also share with me if that includes that whole thing about suffering as part of it.
Yes. So I do a one-man show. I'm working on it right now. It's called Art Is Not a Four-Letter Word. And people are like, well, right, Paul, it's three. But the point is it took me almost a decade to say out loud that I was an artist. I would use terms like designer, or I'm a fabricator, or I'm a, you know, I build things. And the reason is because when I would say I'm an artist, you can see it on the person's face. They go, does he say, do you want fries with that? Or how do you want your coffee? And it's like, no, I'm a paid artist. And I have found the analogy that I like to use is that artists are seen a lot like clergy. Because you're closer to God, you should be on your knees. And I don't like that analogy very much. I think that, like, if most people go home at the end of their normal work, normal job type of situation, they go home to relax, and they relax using the things that creatives and artists make. And they need that to unwind. And yet, because I'm in a position where I can make that, I can create that for myself and for others, that is my payment. And I've spent like the last, I think like 10, 12 years talking to other artists and saying, your value is in more than the materials that you're putting out there. You have to account for your time and such. And the starving artist, It's harder and harder now for artists to gain footage, because manufacturing can be done so cheap. And so when you have people who are, you know, knitting a blanket and it takes 10, 20, 30, 40 hours, and they're still, and the materials themselves are expensive, it's really hard to justify $700, $800 for a blanket. So you have to figure out, like, how do I justify that pricing? But then, if you think about it, it's like, who am I justifying it to? Like, to myself, it's definitely worth every bit of that. So then it's trying to change the mindset of the customer. And so when we're talking about like the struggling, the pain of the starving artist. It's not art is a skill. Just like, you know, I went to school and I never actually took art lessons. I just kind of like absorbed. But it is a skill that is learned and honed over time. There's a great story about Pablo Picasso that they tell, where he was sitting on a park bench and a woman comes up to him and goes, "Excuse me, are you Pablo Picasso?" He goes, "Yes, ma'am, I am." She's like, "Can you draw me a picture? You know, draw my picture." He's like, "Absolutely." And he does three lines on a piece of paper and he hands it to her. She goes, "That's beautiful." And he goes, "That'll be $10,000. She's like, why is it 10,000? It's just three lines on a piece of paper. It took you no time at all." He goes, "No, it took me a lifetime to draw three lines." And that's really what it is. So while we struggle and we have the pains of art of learning this, I think it's important to realize that it is a constant. And, you know, mental health with an artist is a lot different than because we have it's like a star being born in our head whenever we're creating, and we've got to take that formation and then push it through our system, out through our hands, to create and hope that somebody wants it. And so we're pouring emotion, and for like a painter, you see that in their expression. But when you're working on a job, like if you're working on a movie set or you're working in any industry, and I like to use the word creatives instead of artists, because I think that, you know, a chef, a construction worker, you know, anybody can be a creative as long as you're dedicated to the art that you're performing, whatever that art might be. And that skill set takes time to hone and build. And that is that's the challenge that we go through. And I think it's really important that that is recognized by others. I actually had a customer who was haggling with me on my pricing. And I said, "Okay, first off, you're not going to be my customer because I don't want to haggle. But second, I said, is it okay if I went to your work and told you what you're going to make for the day?" And he's like, "Well, no, I earn a salary." I'm like, "Well, so do I. So why are you trying to do that to me?" I was like, it's the same thing. But that mindset that we have from a customer point of view towards other artists is that, well, because it's art, it should be cheaper. It should be widely available. And I get fired up.
No, I see it. I get it. And I also, that's a similar conversation I have to people who are solopreneurs, right? Like, "Well, I have to charge cheaper." I'm going, "Why?" "Well, I'm just starting out." And I'm thinking, "Okay, look, you're 45 years old. You're not just starting out. You brought three decades of work to this work, right? So let's get real. What is the value? Let's think about your value." But that takes me back to also, and I like what you said, how the customer perceives it. So if I'm going to lay out $700 or $800 for a blanket, quote unquote, I'm not buying it as a commodity, like a blanket I might put on my bed. I'm buying it because it's special to me. I may use it that way, right? But my mindset or my thinking around it is different. Am I following you correctly?
It's absolutely true, because you're not investing in materials. There's two different values when you're valuing art. There's material value and there's perceived value. When you're investing in art, you're investing in the artist. Anybody, like, and this is the AI is really big right now. That's like the hot topic that everybody wants to talk about. And artists are going to lose their jobs because AI can create art. And it's not true, because when you have a computer create the art, it's missing something. We have machines that can 3D print Michelangelo's David, but if you set it next to Michelangelo's David, there's something missing. And that thing that is missing is errors. The errors are the humanity that we're putting into our art. When we make things, like I've got one right here I just finished. It's this beautiful sculpture. It's a memorial sculpture of a firefighter who passed away. And they wanted this pose. And he's like, "Oh, is there a way that you can, you know, 3D make it, 3D print it and all this?" And I'm like, I would, but I don't want to, because you'll miss the life. The statue won't have that. You know, it's a memorial. You want to put the emotion back into it, and machines can't put in emotions. And so when you are investing $700 in a blanket or whatever into the thing, you're asking for the error of humanity to be put into it, the bit of the soul of the artist to be put into it. And that's what gives it its value. It's not material. It's the perception.
Yeah. And I think there is that whole worry about AI, but I've noticed I use it a lot just to outline things and stuff. But honestly, it misses the heart.
It does.
It does. It's like, absolutely. Okay, that's kind of close, but what the heck?
It talks in circles.
It doesn't work. So let me take it from here, right? That'd be like sending it out to buy you the supplies for the artist. Okay, go get those supplies for me, and then I'll take it from there, right?
It's a tool, and I think it's an important tool. And I actually use 3D printers, and I'll use AI, and I use it as a tool like I would a hammer or a saw. You know, I have a hand saw, but I also have a band saw, which makes it a lot faster because I can just hit a button, work myself through it. It's just an upgraded tool. We're just making it more efficient. And I love that idea, because when we have more efficiency in our workflow, what we are left with is time to be human. We have time to put the emotions back into things. Because we don't have to worry about all of our time being, you know, lost in the monotony of the job.
Right.
Hey there, everybody. I want to take just a minute out of this episode of the No Labels, No Limits podcast to tell you that we are officially opening the Sandbox membership in September. So if you're not already on our mailing list, please click the link below to either sign up for the membership or get on the waiting list for the membership. And if you click the link, you'll find more information about what's included, what our plans are, and better yet, you'll be on early enough to help decide what is most important to you to experience in the first 3 to 6 months of the membership. So don't wait. Click the link below and join us in the sandbox, where fun happens. We get to do a little R&R, little learning, support one another, and really grow and expand in ourselves, in our lives, and impact the world in a profound way. So come on over, join us.
So now, I love that you like calling artists creative. And I think I was just going to laugh, because I work with one of my partners, Ken, is in film, right? And I watch him. We'll go on to client meetings. And I'm the strategic person. Like, I'm thinking ahead about how are they going to use this, all that. I can watch his face, and he's way down the road. He's already got a vision, right? So he doesn't talk. We have this thing. It's like, just let me make sure we're on the same page with the client before you start going. But I can watch his face. I know. He's like, okay, here's 3 or 4 ways we could do this. Let's run, and we can do our work with whomever we're working with. But it does, it's exhausting. I mean, for me, because that's not my default, right? He lives in the creative, right? He'll go, okay, what about this? What about this? I'm thinking, you're exhausting, right? You're constantly creating. He goes, I don't know how to do the world otherwise. And it's so great. But I'm grateful for that as part of our team, because my default is analysis, right? I want data. I want information, not because I will use the data, but it helps me come up with a strategy. So I'm curious, from the perspective of business and how you're helping companies think differently about integrating creatives more efficiently, or the impact of them being leveled up more, I guess I'd say, in the business. Can you talk about that a bit with us?
Absolutely. I love the term that you said, leveling up, because I use that a lot with creatives, because that is how we, I love video game like terminology, because I'm with creatives, it really like, oh, wow, I'm leveled up now. That's great. It is one of the biggest challenges right now is working with companies and corporations, because management is my wife is a full-time costume designer. She works for a theater. This is her job. She is the main costume designer. And we have this challenge almost every conversation about how the people who are upstairs, they're the office people, don't quite understand how the machine of creativity works. And when budgets become tight, the first thing they cut is the art. But when your entire business is based around art, how do you keep cutting those strings? Because they don't mingle, because they don't much like you, they're analytical. They don't understand the process of the creativity. And so when I'm speaking with bosses, when I'm speaking with management, I have to emphasize that for your business to grow, the first thing you have to do is you have to give space for creatives to create. And I like, again, use the word creatives, because it's not necessarily art. Computer programmers are just as much of a creative as anyone else. But deadlines, endless meetings, things that can be handled with quick notes, those things need to disappear to give people a little bit more time and leeway. the best thing that happened to creatives was the pandemic, because work from home showed, like, everyone's eyes got a little bit brighter, because they realized that I can do all of my work in a third of the time, and then I have time to just be, you know, to become human, you know, to create, to be human again. And but then now we're still in the pandemic, but we think we're coming out of it, and we're having to force ourselves back into these buildings because the companies own the buildings and they can't just leave them empty. And so they're trying to incentivize, but they don't understand that, you know, a free meal is not incentive enough. It's give me space for autonomy to create, but to fail just enough so that I can understand. One of my favorite things to do when I go into a company is I'm like, I want to see your training videos. They're like, why? And I'm like, please let me see them. And it is. And the reason I like that is because it shows me exactly how wrong they're approaching their job. And it's not bad to have training, but what happens with training is that you find somebody who does the job really, really well. They were given space and autonomy to do the job, to figure out how best to do it. And then an upper management person who doesn't understand the process goes, you figure this out. We're going to film you and then tell everyone to do it exactly that way. And then they become these like cookie cutters. But much like a photocopy of a photocopy of a photocopy, eventually something gets lost in translation. And so then you're trying to force somebody to do something a way that is unnatural to them. And it hurts them in a mental, metaphysical type of way, that they're trying to fit themselves into a box that they don't work well in. And so they feel drained from it. It is going to work instead of, you know, I'm at a job that I enjoy. If companies, like if your management can actually give them a little bit of say, these are your parameters, this is your goal. And one of the things that I teach is like four steps to solving any problem. And I know you can't solve every problem, but one of the steps is understanding, recognizing the solution. Like, what are we trying to accomplish here? Then let's build backwards from that. And I think once we understand that, and your management understands that, you give people autonomy on their job, you give them a little bit of space to fail a little bit, to figure how best to do it, everything improves. Output improves, morale improves, profits improve, you know, people become faster. But what then starts to happen is when you become more efficient, the job doesn't reward you for being more efficient by giving you time off. They reward you by giving you more work, but no more reward. And I think that's the hardest part for employers to understand, is that because somebody is more efficient, like, honestly, if you had a job for 10 years, I would hope that after 10 years, you would be faster at it. Yet I know people who have had the same job for 10 years, and it's still the exact same amount of time every single week. And I was telling you before we started, I have a friend of mine who says he's become really good at watching YouTube and not getting caught, because he can do his job so fast, but he's required to be there, and he doesn't want to have to take on a bunch more workload because he doesn't get any more incentive for it. So
incentive, in your mind, is incentive always cash, or is it other things?
It can be a myriad of things. Honestly, the best incentive for people is time. Time is our most valuable asset.
I agree.
Money's great, but what does money buy you? It buys you shortcuts so you have more time. It allows you to pay your bills so you don't have to go and get another job. Money is nice, but time is invaluable. And so what I say is, you know, if somebody is efficient enough to do their job in 20 hours, let them go. Let them do their job in 20 hours. But they're like, but we have this building we have to pay for. Sell the building. They don't want to hear that. But that's really the solution. Like, you can be just as efficient, or you can pay for these people to sit there, and they will be creative, and they will creatively figure out how to fool you into looking busy. And then what do they get? So they're going to get their time, just like you're going to get your results, but you're going to pay for them to sit there, and then they lose morale. And creative people, we need more. And so if we don't get that more, we're going to find it, we're going to pull it from somewhere else, and the thing that's going to suffer is the job.
So I like that you talked about, like, knowing where you're going. Like, you can communicate, this is the purpose of what we're doing, right? Mm-hmm. This is the outcome of it. So it sounds to me like one of the analogies I like is thinking of as a bowling alley, right? Like, our goal is to get all those pins down. you can do it any way you want, but stay within the lane, right? You don't get to go over here and bring in a bunch of other resources or whatever. Do it this way and just let me know how mm-hmm. it's going if you got problems. And when it's done, great. So that you're giving autonomy or authority, if you will, or ownership, you can use different words, to whomever, to take a lead on that and be proud of what they're doing. Am I getting where you're going?
Absolutely. Being able to have that ownership, like, you're more prideful. If you were given the cookie cutter and said you have to fit within this, you have to stay within this boundary, then you don't feel like you're contributing. You're a being a machine, but we're not machines, we're humans. So if I said, this is our outcome, and I want this outcome, and I give it to the same outcome to six different people, and I said, you just get there in this amount of time, and honestly, you've got this amount of time, and if you get it done quicker, great, but I want to see how you get there. You'll have six different ways they approach it.
Yeah.
And that ownership gives them pride because they're like, ooh, I figured it out. I figured it out. And so this is my method. And then when you have that, then you become that very first person who figured it out. And the bosses are like, I'm going to make the training manuals out of you. You become that autonomy, that ownership of your job becomes so much more valuable to you. And then you feel invaluable to the company.
Yep. So how has that gone for you when you talk, like, people bring you in from upper management and you say, okay, here's what I consider important for you to think about. How are you received?
It's a 50-50 is honestly how it is. And I really wish that I really wish it was received better. I think I can inspire and they see it and they're like, that sounds great. But it's in its practice that there's a loss of control that management doesn't like to give up, that because it's all a balancing act, you know, because unfortunately the management that I'm dealing with, they still have managers, you know, and we're going to go all the way to the top. And it's a game of Jenga where they're, you know, everybody's pieces are teetering. And unfortunately we're all taking on more workload because we're trimming the fat on all these companies. And it's like, well, if I let go of some of this control, is the tower going to fall? And when it falls, it's going to fall on my shoulders. I'm going to lose my job. And so unfortunately with management, depending on where they're at, the ones who have accepted it, their businesses flourish, but it's a matter of faith. And lack of control is a really big sticking point with some management.
Yeah, well, when you first do it, it's a little scary, but then all of a sudden when you're going, wow, not only is the team doing great, but I feel great. And I like work better, and we all, you know, I mean, it can be scary at the beginning, but if you're actually dedicated and follow through on it, you're going to have bumps. Nothing's going to be perfect. You're going to have some learning curve, but the payoff can be so just beyond dollars and cents. The payoff can be really powerful. And in longevity of people who come up with better ideas, mm-hmm. maybe on another project, they're just looking, they're not even on it. And they're going, you know what? I think we have an opportunity to refine something over here.
But most times, and it's true, if somebody spoke up like that, stay in your lane is the answer. And it's unfortunate that we don't want to accept that. And again, it's all about that balance, you know. It's like, know your place. And I'm like, I step out of the box, guys. We don't have to. And you don't want to work in chaos, and I understand that. And because nothing comes from chaos, but you've got to allow for failure. You mentioned, you know, that change in the space that you have to give. I've met a lot of people in my life. I have yet to meet anybody who has learned something from success. Everybody learns from failure. It is the best learning tool. And, you know, when I do something right, I'm like, well, I did it, but it doesn't set in here. To prove this point, I want everybody who's listening to this right now, when you're having this sitting late at night, you can't get to sleep, you're not thinking about, you're thinking about the time that you messed up in, you know, in third grade when your zipper was down. You're not thinking about the time that you succeeded. You're thinking about all the little years in life. And it's the truth. You've got to learn from that failure. Failure doesn't need to be catastrophic, though. It just needs to be that didn't work. When I, I talked to some, I like to do this session, it's like an ideation session where I talk to businesses. And one of my questions is always, you know, like if you have a magic wand and you waved it, what would you fix instantaneously if you could fix one thing? And everybody has, you know, a myriad of answers. And I'm like, you understand that the answer that you're giving me is the one thing that you really want fixed. And every time it can be fixed very easily, if you just allow somebody a little bit of wiggle room, that can be solved. But it's that balance act. They don't want to let go of the reins. It's too hard to let go.
Well, and I think too, there's a, I don't want to say a misunderstanding, but I think there's, it's really important to have systems, especially if you're large, right? And you've got people who want to know where the heck am I on this process or what's our rules around here so I can function to my best. It's that balance between having systems and processes, but to remember that those are there to serve the business, not to for the employees and staff to be a slave to the tools.
Correct.
Right. Absolutely. So it's great that you have an accounting system. It's great that you have project. It's great you have all this stuff, but is it taking more time? Is it causing friction? Do you even need it? Right. So, and creatives are always thinking like, oh, I'm not sure we need this. We need this aspect of it, but we don't need this whole schlug, if you will. So I am curious though, you know, you talk about, creating that culture. If I was just tuning in, I'm thinking, I think that you might be describing me and my business. What is one of the first steps I could do as an owner, a upper management person, to help my creatives on the team? A, to learn to identify who they are, because you don't always know who they are. They might be working in a job that you think is not a creative position. So to help myself identify who they are, and then a step that says how to pull something out of them that they may just be waiting to give.
It's the good old suggestion, Bob. when you're approaching this, the big fear is getting fired, losing your job. That is the biggest fear. So when you're asking your employees to give suggestions, you know, how would you change this? The employee, unfortunately, we've been trained to think they're asking because they're going to fire me or I'm not doing something correct. I think the biggest approach that works well is you give a solution or a problem. You know, this is what we want. And it's usually, I start with a solution. Like what's the end goal that we're after? And then say, look, I would like you to create a proposal. How would you solve this problem? And there is no wrong answer. You may not implement this thing. It may be something so simple. When I hire people for my job as assistants, I make them make me two cakes. One of them has to come from a recipe and the other one cannot. And I don't care how you do it. But the reason is because I want to see that you can follow directions and I want to see that you can be creative enough to figure it out. And it's the same approach that you can use. I mean, you could literally have them, you know, do something that doesn't have anything to do necessarily with the job, but just give, you want to understand like how they would creatively process an answer, how they can get from A to Z and see if they even need all the letters in between. The bigger thing is that we're all under these tight deadlines. So firstly, when you're in a room and meetings, I'm not a huge fan of meetings. I think they can be an astronomical waste of time because typically they're just check-ins and that can all be done with emails or phone messages or whatever. But ideation meetings, I think, are great. Sit down with your team, whatever your collective team is, and then say, look, we are short whatever. I would like to just throw out ideas, have a whiteboard available, and just write down anything. There are no dumb answers. I hate to say stupid answers, whatever. There are no stupid answers, but what you have to do is you have to understand where they're coming from. You're going to get a lot of stupid answers right off the bat because people are going to be either yes men or they're going to be afraid to speak. And so they're going to say something that's not going to necessarily get there. But eventually, he's like, so I would ask, you know, we're short, you know, we're not going to hit our goals this quarter. How can we hit our goals? Is anybody have any suggestions? There's no dumb answers, you know, and it could be as simple as, I don't know, remove an olive from the jar. Well, that's the dumbest thing. That saved that company $1 million. You know, why would that be? You know, do we actually necessarily want to downsize our product? you know, that shrink gate that's happening everywhere. Do we want to do that, or do we want to raise the prices but use maybe a better material? You know, maybe the answer isn't necessarily using less. Maybe it's using more or a little bit better. But you don't know these things until the ideas come out there. When I come into a company, I like to ask them what their pain points are. And we do this exact same thing because most people in the business know their business very well. Every aspect of the chain knows their job really well. And so when I come in, I say, well, what's your pain point? And then I will spitball with them answers. And a lot of times they're like, that would never work, Paul. And I'm like, good, what would? And then they'll just tell me, and I'm like, well, you already knew the answer. It's the Dorothy result, you know, where you've been wearing the ruby slippers the whole time. You know, you could click your heels and have the answer, but you're in the bottle, so you can't read the label. You don't understand that you have the answers there, and you're afraid to speak up. So ideation meetings, I think, are great. It's a good way for management to speak to their team and just give them some room to fail, to ask, to answer, and to not have the fear of being fired, of losing their job, of being downgraded. It's a weird hierarchy that we have been trained to come into and to, you know your place, stay in your lane. Stretching your lane a little bit, you'd be surprised. Pixar's got a really great business model in which they have all of their employees can be a director. They can direct their film. They can be the idea person and then be promoted and do be in charge of this entire event. That's how all of their shorts are made. And I think that's great because you could be the guy who spends 6 months trying to figure out how an eyelid closes and looks really pretty. But then the next time you're directing an entire movie because they give you the ability to have the autonomy, to have the creative growth. And then everybody succeeds in that. It lifts everyone up because no one is constrained by a weird hierarchy with fear of failure.
Yeah, well, and those, I think we're too easy to accept a label or a title, like I am the XYZ, so stay in your lane kind of thing. It's yep. Like, well, I might be the XYZ, but guess what? I have a really great idea for the PQR.
Hot Cheeto guy, he was a janitor. The guy who came up with Flaming Hot for Cheetos. They made a movie out of him. He was like, I really like spicy food. Can we make really spicy Cheetos? That's the dumbest multi-billion-dollar idea we've ever had. You know, just because
it's only dumb until it works.
Exactly.
Yeah. really, that's it. So you have something that you said you would give our listeners about helping creatives figure out what to charge. Now, these are people who work for themselves, or maybe they have a side gig or whatever. Can you talk two things about that besides the download that you're going to offer us? What caused you to create that? What are some of the conversations you've had with creatives around it? And then describe it a bit for us.
It is the most asked question I get as a creative, is really how I stumbled onto it. And the reason is because, again, we talk about material value versus perceived value. So how do we, in a society where we creatives have to be take a cut, how do we figure out our worth? And so I had to sit down and think, like, what are we exactly charging for? Charging for expertise, much like a lawyer would charge for their advice, and that's why their rates are so high, because they have learned and studied and they've spent the time to become the expert. And so definitely had a lot of conversations about this. I would stream on a platform called Twitch, and I would make my art and I'd talk about it. And I did that for about 6 years. And people would see me doing this and they're like, you seem successful. And I'm like, I do okay. And they're like, how do you figure out what to charge? And they just always come in and I'm like, all right, let's break it down. And I'd ask them what they do. It's honestly, I leave a lot of it, and you'll see this in the giveaway that I have. It's a sliding scale, and it relies on you being honest with yourself and your skill level. I think a lot of it is, let's take the material value. That's what it is. I mean, we can't change what it costs to get the materials. That's part of it. The second part of it is time. Well, we know it's going to take X amount of time. And then the third one is, what is your rate? The biggest one that I have to explain to artists is that if you want to charge for your art or whatever it is that you're creating, if you are not charging a rate that is higher than the most minimum wage job in your area, go do that job. Because if you're going to charge less than that, then that's not a career. That's not a job. That's a hobby. And that's okay. Do hobbies. And so that's where we start. So I have a sliding scale, and you'll see it on the giveaway. It starts at zero and it goes to 10. But if you're selling your art or your work or whatever, you always start at five. Five is minimum wage in your area. And I like to say your area because cost of living is different. I live in Nebraska. It's a lot cheaper than living in San Francisco, let me tell you. So my minimum wage here is for me to actually live and sustain and, you know, is actually a lot less than what it would be if I lived in a major city. So I say start there. And then as you progress with your skill level, you need to double your rates. And so when you go from a five to a six, you need to double your rate, because if it takes you 40 hours at a level five, which is your minimum wage, I'm just starting out. If it takes you 40 hours to do a job and you're making $10 an hour, you're going to make $400. Okay. Well, at the next level, you've become faster. Well, why should the guy who's a lot slower earn more than you who's faster? Well, they shouldn't, right? You should earn at least the same amount in less time. So your rate needs to increase. And so it's a mental game, and you've got to really think about it. I've been at this for over 20 years. I'm still not a 10. I refuse to acknowledge that I have maxed out my potential here. But when I look at that scale, I recognize that my level is definitely getting up there, and it's worth it because I can work very efficiently. But that doesn't mean that my work is less than. If anything, it's gotten better. But I need to charge accordingly. And so I think that's a hard one. And then the last little bit that I put in there, and this is one that my father, who later in life decided to make art for a living, he likes to make props for haunted houses and stuff. And this is the one that I'm still trying to get this into his head, is that once you figure out your hourly rate and your material value, you need to tack on profit. Profit is important, kids. If you don't earn a profit, it's still a hobby. You've got to be able to maintain a business and keep it moving forward. And so those three things put together creates this wonderful little scale. And it's about introspection as much as it is about, you know, actual physical material worth.
And sometimes it takes a while for people to acknowledge where they really are. And it's like, okay, I'm down at a five. But you could sit and evaluate what they're doing, how they're working, and find that they're actually maybe closer to a seven, mm-hmm. but they don't see it yet. They don't feel it, right? So they're going to choke every time they say, well, it's going to cost this much. Is that okay? It's like,
and that's why I think setting the five at minimum wage, because that analogy works really well for them, and it works really well for the customer. Because, you know, I'm not down, you know, like McDonald's is a great company, and I think it's a great starter job. You know, a lot of kids from high school work at McDonald's. That's a great intro job. You're going to get, where I live, I think it's $13 an hour. Well, if I'm charging less for than $13 an hour, I might as well work at McDonald's. And so when I'm talking to a customer and they're like, well, how much is it? Well, it took me X amount of time at $13. They're like, well, that's astronomical. Well, it is, except for that's minimum wage here. And so when you can show math to a customer, it's hard for them to refute it. And honestly, I've had to do that. I've literally had to bring out the pad of paper and write down time and hourly rate. And, you know, I've had the argument of, well, your hourly rate is too high. I'm like, yeah, but my hours are really low. So you're going to pay for it regardless. I mean, you can go hire somebody on Etsy and they're going to charge you the same, but they're going to take three, four times as long. So you're going to pay for it one way or the other. But again, I think it goes back to understanding that when you're investing in art, you're investing in the artist and not just in the product that you're receiving.
I also feel that way about business. So when you invest in your team, your staff, your employees, you're investing in the business. And so it's not a waste if you're putting time in for them to learn, to grow, to be creative, to contribute. It really is. It's a, where are we standing as we're looking at the perspective of what's in front of us, the view, the art, creativity, whatever it is. So we'll make sure to have a link to the PDF in the show notes. I'm going to make sure that we have that. And I think, well, there's so many things I could ask you, but I will stay on focus here. It's not that easy. I'm looking at what's sitting behind you. I'm thinking, oh my God, just so many things to play with there. So do you have kids?
I do. I have three.
Okay. And what are their age ranges?
17, 12, and 9.
Okay. So are they following? I mean, your wife sounds like she's also creative.
We are a family of creatives, yes.
Okay. What are they doing?
My oldest is into animation. My middle one is into cooking. And my youngest one is into plot development, is what we like to say. He's a storyteller.
Oh, that is so cool.
It is. I have made it a point as a father. I read to my children 30 to 45 minutes a night. I do all the voices. Whatever my directing acting teacher told me years ago, I still do all the different voices and I read to them so that they have that storyteller mode in their mind. And now when they go to school and have to read out loud, they're doing all the voices themselves. It's important, I think, that we nurture the creativity, but we don't give them the constraint. You know, I have all of this around me and I have every tool you could imagine. Not a single one of my kids wants to use any of it. They have no interest in it whatsoever. And I have a lot of people come down and they like what you see is a small portion of what's actually
I'm
here.
I'm guessing
it's 20, it's a 20 foot wall. And everybody who comes to my studio, they're like, oh my goodness, your kids must love it. Halloween must be the best. And I'm like, eh, they don't care. It's their normal. So what we do is we nurture instead, if my kid wanted to be an accountant, which is also, I think, is a very creative job in itself, we would embrace it wholeheartedly. They don't want to embrace whatever creative aspect they want. But we found it was interesting with my middle child that his passion lies in food. And we hadn't thought, well, that's really interesting. I mean, he likes music and he likes food. And we're like, well, how can we just nurture that? And it's like, well, let's let him experiment with food and we'll all try it. And it's not all great, but we can embrace that challenge. Instead of tamping it down, we just kind of let him run with it.
That is totally cool to be able to do that. And you know, there's so many types of creatives and artists. I would love your middle child to come be near me. I would test the food. Come be my chef. I will pay you.
Be careful what you wish for. But
oh,
it's
so
good.
It's not that great. Okay.
It is. He's got some things that are down pat that we're like, you're on dinner tonight, buddy. I mean, he's 12, but we're like, ah, you're in charge on these meals. And
yeah,
when we
never underestimate by age.
No, never.
I was just sharing with someone that I'm a big audiobook listener. Mm-hmm. And I read a lot also, but the one thing I listened to this book, I never would have read this book except I met the author who's a friend of my sister's, yada, yada. But I wouldn't have picked the book up. It didn't really say anything to me. Now my sister says, I said, I'm going to read them because I respect this gal. So I listened to it and the actor who was doing the voices, who did all of the voices, and there were many in this book. I was enthralled. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking, okay, where's this? I went right on to the library. Get me the second, get me the third. So I went through about 40 hours of this book. And only the third book had more than one voice actor on it, but the same woman did all of it. And I thought everything came alive because of that art, you know, yeah. And I could smell things. I could see it. It takes place in India, right? So I'm seeing all this. It was magnificent. I'm thinking, thank God that that person is such a great artist and creative, you know, and it's invisible. I think we don't always think about the art that surrounds us and enriches our lives.
It's everywhere. It is absolutely everywhere.
So what's next up for you, Paul? What's up for the, you know, this, we're only one quarter into the year. So
we are, it's stages trying to, I'm working, I'm finding more clients. I'm looking for creatives who are interested in pursuing this full time and would like to have a leg up. That's a big one for me. And then finding companies who really want to embracing their employees and giving and elevating their business. And it's not by just throwing money at it, but just really elevating their business and moving ahead. And then I love speaking on stages. If you're looking for somebody to kind of walk you through the creative process from a really outside the box perspective, I'm your guy. So stages and working with companies and corporations and creatives.
Well, that's a good way to go forward because I think we're in a new phase of work. I think we're still going to do great work, but I think the pandemic ended up being good. I do say it's over. And for me, it's like, I think the constraints are done. We need to start thinking new about things. And, And there, because we had to pivot, we know we can pivot.
Necessity is the mother of change. And it is, you know, globally or locally, it absolutely is.
I want to thank you for being on the podcast, Paul. And I will leave you with the last word of encouragement for our listeners. It's all you.
Well, thank you very much, first of all, for having me here as your guest. It's wonderful. Embrace change and embrace creativity. I think there is nothing stronger than creativity. We are ambassadors to the human soul. So embrace your creatives, embrace creativity in yourself. Don't feel that you need to be an artist to be creative. We all have our gifts to give, and embrace them and share them with the world. We all want it.
You've been listening to the No Labels, No Limits podcast with best-selling author, change agent, and strategic business coach, Sarah Box. You can grab the show notes and find out how to work with Sarah at sarahbox.com/No Labels, No Limits podcast. We'd love this podcast to reach as many people as possible. Please remember to rate, leave a 5-star review, and share the podcast with someone you think would get value from this conversation. Till next time, keep taking those daily action steps to align your purpose to your principles and achieve your goals in business and life.